Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey everybody, I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains language and topics that may not be suitable for all listeners. The topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Okay, so as everybody can tell from the intro, Andy's not here this week. Mandy had her family pass away, so she's taking a couple episodes off to go through that whole grieving process and everything that entails with that. So instead, in Mandy's place, for the next couple episodes, we have Mama that is going to be with us.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, and you can talk whenever.
I usually do.
You don't have to wait for any cues. So we're not changing any of the cases that we had planned. It's just Mama instead of Mandy for the next couple episodes. I'm not 100% sure we have a date set for when she's going to come back, but, you know, things happen. These things are difficult, so.
Yeah. Oh, don't I know it.
Yeah. So we're not sure 100% when Mandy will be back, but Mama will be standing in her place. So hopefully she'll be back soon. With us?
Yeah, because y'all may not like me.
Whatever. Okay, so I realized when I was writing this one that we've done almost 80 episodes.
Dadgum.
Yeah. You've been there for all of them.
Well, I've been there for the biggest part of them.
Yeah.
Especially when y'all would take over my bedroom.
I know. You've been in the background of a few of them.
Several.
Yep. So almost 80.
Wow. That's amazing.
I know. I didn't realize. Obviously, it's been over a year, but I didn't realize it was that many until I was.
Well, there's only 52 weeks a year, girlfriend. So you're doing something right.
I know. So for over a year and for nearly 80 episodes, we've tracked the shadow of human depravity across the entire globe.
Yeah, you've had some sick stories.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more to come.
Yeah, buddy.
So in the spirit of this season specifically, Halloween, spooky season, we have veered from our true crime roots and we've covered everything from haunted lakes and spooky games to witches, curses, dolls, myths, and folklore with a little bit of true crime mixed in there. But today we're going to veer sharply back to those true crime roots. Back to where we began, because sometimes the greatest monster isn't a myth or legend, but instead it is flesh and blood.
There's some sick puppies out there.
Oh, yeah. So today's case.
I think I married a few. I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
I can't with you. Okay. So for today's case. This one takes place on the very date that caps spooky season, Halloween.
That's right. It was Halloween, huh?
Mm-hmm. And the monster, in today's case, was far closer to home than any myth could ever be. So Halloween has always been a season where fact and folklore blur together. For centuries, people have gathered around fires and living room lamps to trade stories of witches, spirits, and things that go bump in the night. But what we sometimes forget is that many of those stories were rooted in real fear, and often in real tragedy. A neighbor's strange behavior could turn into a tale of witchcraft. A missing child became the seed of a ghost story whispered for generations. The line between monster and man has always been very thin. And that's what makes true crime in October hit extremely differently. We can brace ourselves for haunted houses and horror movies because we know they aren't real. But when we talk about a case like this, a family annihilation that unfolded in the middle of a quiet Ohio town on Halloween night, no less, we're faced with something scarier than any ghost. The fact that the darkest horrors often come from the people closest to us.
No kidding.
So we're heading to Martin, Ohio. For a catastrophic failure of family and system. It's a story of horrific violence that occurred right there right where safety should have been guaranteed, exposing the brutal, tragic consequences of an unaddressed crisis. This is a heart-wrenching case about a familial implosion and a brutal reminder of how thin the line between care and catastrophe truly is. So, if you're ready for this deep dive.
I'm ready.
So we're heading to Ohio, and we're going to talk about the List family murders. So Martin was a sort of place where life moved slowly. It was measured more by seasons than it was by headlines. In October, the cornfields that stretched out around the town would be golden and brittle, ready for harvest. Church bells still marked the rhythm of Sundays, and Friday nights were for football games at the nearest high school. People here left their doors unlocked, not out of carelessness, but out of habit. When your neighbors have known you since childhood, trust becomes second nature.
Well, I don't ever remember my grandma locking her doors.
I don't think Grandpa ever locked his either, did he?
No. Now, he did when he went to bed. But if he went just uptown, no, he didn't lock the door.
I mean, it was a super small town that we lived in, too.
And
but
everybody knew everybody.
Right. And they lived there. Grandpa grew up in that town. So
no, Grandma did.
Oh, yeah. Grandma grew up in that. He grew up in the town next over.
Yeah. No town over.
So, I mean, back then, you just didn't. There are people still today that don't lock their doors. Which, that won't happen.
Not in this house.
When Mandy told me she slept with her bedroom windows open, I wanted to slap her.
I slept with my bedroom window open.
You're crazy. What is wrong with you?
You have pit bulls. I don't worry about it.
You have never listened to Morbid. Fresh air is for dead people.
I love my fresh air, especially if it's a nice fall night. Oh.
But I guess this window and that window over there is a little different.
Now, that one I wouldn't leave open.
Yeah, no, because this one's
but
right
this
up.
One.
It's a little different because it's right there where the fence is.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, no, that ain't happening.
Yeah, no. There's been times where, like, we've turned around to make sure on our way to work that we locked the door. People couldn't remember. But there are people even here in town that don't lock their doors.
I don't think some of the neighbors don't.
Mm-mm.
Not me.
Right.
I remember I lived in too many big cities.
Right. You could live. I have never lived in a big city, but.
The biggest city you lived in is Lenoir.
Or Atoma. I'm not sure which one's bigger. But even that's really
I think Atoma was bigger, really.
Anyway, so Halloween in Martin was no different. Kids bundled into costumes, padded by sweatshirts against the chill of the Midwestern autumn, while parents swapped gossip at the end of driveways. Porch lights flickered on one by one, casting familiar streets in a cozy orange glow. There was safety in the sameness, the sense that in Martin, nothing could truly go wrong. Which is why what happened that night sent a shockwave so deep through the town that it shattered not just one family, but the illusion of safety the entire community had lived under.
Wow.
So the home that we're focusing on was located on State Route 2, and it belonged to the Lisk family. On the surface, they were a seemingly typical blended family. William, who went by Bill, Lisk Sr., he was 53. He was an established resident of the area. He was a United States Air Force veteran and worked as a front-end loader for waste management.
I don't know, but it's the List family murders that I'm familiar with.
Yes.
Okay, Kim, this is a new one.
Yep.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, yep. This one you don't know. I know it gets mixed up because if you say it too fast, they sound the same. But this one is Lisk, L-I-S-K-E.
Not List, L-I-S-T.
Yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep. This one you don't know.
I'm about to.
Yep. Okay. So Bill was known to love hunting, fishing, and gardening. He was the very definition of a man who cherished his land and the outdoors. His wife, Susan List, who was 46, was the office manager for the Northwest Ohio Carpenters Joint Apprenticeship and Training Community. I feel like they could have shortened that. She was a dedicated professional with an associate's degree. The two had been married in 2001. They joined their families into one unit. So they were a blended family.
Oh, this was a lot sooner than the other one, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the other one was like in the 50s.
Yeah, that one's really old.
Yeah. Oh, now you really got my attention. Okay, go for it.
So they each had sons from previous marriages. And the blended family, in the eyes of their neighbors, were just normal. They were a normal, perfectly blended family. But inside that home, the reality was a pressure cooker of stress, fear, and escalating tension. It was a toxic brew hidden behind the closed doors of an American dream. While fear was unfolding inside the List home, outside the world looked ordinary. Neighbors' porches glowed with carved pumpkins, flickering candlelight giving jack-o'-lanterns crooked grins. Trick-or-treaters were still buzzing from the night before, comparing stashes of candy and laughing about which houses gave out the best stuff. Families were raking leaves, stringing up decorations, and settling into the cozy rhythm of a late October weekend. That's part of what makes this case so haunting. Halloween is supposed to be the one night of the year when fear is staged. A rubber mask, a plastic skeleton, a prank that makes you laugh once your heart stops racing. But in Martin, Ohio, Halloween night of 2010, the real monster wasn't at the end of a dark street. He was sitting at the dinner table, carrying a sickness that no one knew how to cure. So the calendar turned to Sunday, October 31st, 2010, Halloween. A day where the community was preoccupied with carved pumpkins, candy hauls, and the harmless pretense of fear. Instead, in the early morning hours, sometime between the late night quiet of Saturday and the rising sun of Sunday, a silent, vicious assault took place. A darkness had crept in, not from the outside world, but from the very heart of the List family itself. The first person to step inside the home on that Sunday afternoon was Devin Griffin. Susan List's youngest son was just 16 years old. He had returned home from his Sunday church service. He had trudged up to his room to play video games, but at around 1:30, somewhere that afternoon, the quiet of the home had finally hit him. His mother, Susan, would normally have been out of bed by then. And where was the rest of their family? So Devin went downstairs and walked into the master bedroom. He found his mom, Suzanne List, in bed next to his stepfather, Bill List Sr. A maroon comforter was pulled high, completely covering their heads. Devin started talking, trying to wake up his mom. He walked around her side of the bed and saw that her foot was just, you know, jutting out from underneath the covers. He tapped on her leg. No response. Devin continued to talk to Susan, pulling the covers down just a little bit. And that's when he saw her pillow, completely soaked with blood. For a moment, the violence was so absolute, so overwhelming, that the teenage boy initially thought that it was just a morbid Halloween prank, telling authorities that it looked like the remnants of a party joke. But slowly and horribly, he realized that it wasn't. This was death, cold and final. He ran from the room and out of the house. He did not know yet the true extent of the horror that he had just found.
Damn.
He ran outside the house and called his aunt, Lori Morsi. I believe that's how you say her last name. That's Suzanne's sister. She then quickly contacted 911. She had already had suspicions on what was going on because she had called Susan, but no answer had ever happened. So him coming over, telling her, you know, I found mom, her pillow soaked in blood. She immediately called 911. So Lori would later tell reporters that the family had, quote, a lot of trouble with the suspected perpetrator and that Susan had been, quote, threatened before. A chilling revelation that immediately put police on high alert. So as officers from the Ottawa County Sheriff's Office swarmed rural residents, the full horror was finally discovered. Bill Sr. and Susan were found in the master bedroom dead from severe trauma to both of their heads.
Damn.
It was also determined that Derek Griffin, Devin's 23-year-old brother, was found elsewhere in the home, also being brutally murdered.
Damn.
The autopsies would later confirm that all three victims had suffered severe trauma to the head, inflicted by both gunshots and bludgeoning, a clear sign of overkill.
Man, they couldn't make up their minds?
Apparently not. Yep. The primary murder weapon was later confirmed to be a handgun. According to the sickening intimacy of the crime, Bill Lisk Sr. was reportedly found with a blanket draped over his head, a gesture of denial or repulsion by the killer, meaning that the killer knew their victims.
A crime of passion.
That's the where the overkill comes from, and that's why their heads are covered.
Because they feel some kind of remorse.
It's more of like they don't want to see what they just did.
Which is remorse, honey.
I guess.
A four.
Depends on who it is.
Yeah, exactly.
So as officers from the sheriff's office swarmed the residence, the direction of the investigation was set by one vital fact. There were no signs of forced entry, which meant the killer was known to the family.
Well, and if the doors weren't locked, hello?
Not only that, they fully believed the killer lived there.
Oh, shoot.
So while the victims, Bill Sr., Susan, and Derek, were confirmed, one person was not accounted for. William B.J. Lisk Jr., Bill Sr.'s 24-year-old son.
Damn!
His absence was deafening. He had not only vanished from the scene, but had taken his father's pickup truck and a handgun, making his departure rapid and premeditated. Authorities immediately designated B.J. Lisk their prime suspect in this triple homicide. The manhunt for the armed and dangerous 24-year-old began immediately. The small town of Martin suddenly realized the monster they feared was flesh and blood, and he was on the loose. However, the horror that morning was quickly followed by a sense of grim relief, because later that same day, Sunday, October 31st, B.J. Lisk Jr. was located and apprehended.
Where'd they find him at? Did it say?
One second. Yeah. You're going to call him an idiot.
Okay.
Okay. He was found approximately 170 miles from the murder scene, near the family's remote cabin in Carroll County, Ohio.
What an idiot.
Told you.
That's going to be the first place they look.
Yep.
Dumbass, you got to get...
Not to make light of it, but...
Fucking moron.
I knew you were going to say that. So, B.J. Lisk was taken into custody and charged with the murder of his father, William Lisk Sr., and prosecutor Mark Mulligan announced his immediate intention to upgrade those charges to 3 counts of aggravated murder, convinced that all 3 killings were premeditated. The manhunt was now over. Now, the deeper, more monstrous questions about why this happened took place. So first, the investigators were to enter the Lisk home. This was a quiet farmhouse set against the backdrop of rural farmland. They were confronted with a scene that defied belief for its brutality and its intimacy. The initial observation, Devin Griffin's belief that it was a morbid Halloween prank, was a testament to the sheer unlikelihood of such a horrific event occurring within that peaceful setting. So the forensic reconstruction quickly established a timeline and pattern of attack that supported the prosecution's claim of premeditation. But it differed from a spontaneous psychotic episode. So they're like, it's premeditated, but it might have just been a psychotic episode. So it really
could have been a psychotic break.
Right. So the violence was perpetrated using a combination of a firearm and a blunt object, demonstrating a terrifying intent to ensure death.
Now, did they ever figure out what the blunt object was?
They have, like, they speculate on what it could be, but I don't think they ever actually found it.
Okay.
So, Bill Lisk and his wife, Susan, were found in their bed. They had suffered, both had suffered gunshot wounds and blunt force trauma. Crucially, Bill was found with a blanket over his head. This detail is forensically significant. In cases of premeditated murder, covering the victim's head or face can serve multiple psychological functions. So it can be a conscious effort by the killer to distract themselves from the identity of the person, or a tactical choice to muffle the sound and conceal the final act. So it leads back to kind of depends on who it is. Now, Susan List, I know I keep saying Suzanne and Susan. Sorry, guys. So Susan List was attacked with extreme violence, displaying evidence of repeated blunt force trauma in addition to fatal gunshot wounds.
He must not have liked her very much.
So the multiple forms of assault suggest a personalized rage-fueled attack consistent with the history of, quote, friction BJ had had with his stepmother.
They didn't like each other.
Yep, there was a lot of tension between the two. So the forensic evidence confirmed that she was the primary target of the killer's sustained hostility. So that's who he went after. Everyone else was just collateral damage, basically.
Damn.
Yeah. So Derek Griffin was found in a separate location. He had been attacked with the same combination of methods. The nature of his wounds confirmed that he was likely just a casualty of the sweep of the house. He was killed to eliminate a witness or because he had woken up during the initial attack. So the use of a blunt object alongside the gun showed a chilling efficiency, a determination to complete the task regardless of the immediate tool available.
Shit, he wanted to make sure they were dead.
Yep. Didn't matter what was used. So analysis of the blood spatter patterns throughout the home helped investigators map the sequence of events. So these splatter patterns were concentrated and fixed. This confirmed that the victims were attacked where they had laid or where they were cornered at, rather than during a prolonged struggle that moved throughout the house.
So they could have been sleeping when he attacked them.
Most likely, yes, that's what's believed.
Is dang. That
they were in bed asleep and he attacked them. And then her oldest son, Derek, was most likely woke up and then he was attacked because he was seen as a witness.
Yeah.
So this fixed location evidence bolstered the argument that the victims were ambushed while they were sleeping or already incapacitated. So he could have drugged their drinks.
For all we know.
With some kind of sleeping medication.
Yeah.
Which that would explain why he was able to attack both Bill and Susan.
Without the dad getting up and protecting the wife.
Right. Or the wife trying to protect him. By first.
Well, she was the primary target.
Well, right. He could have went after her first, but if he was asleep in bed, he would have attacked his dad first.
To keep him from stopping.
Right.
Oh, that, yeah, that makes sense too.
And giving them sleeping medication.
He just got them all screwed. He just got them all fucked up.
Right. Like, obviously, this is all speculation, guys. So the firearm that was used was confirmed to be a handgun that belonged to Bill. So he used his dad's gun to kill them all. And it was the same handgun that was found on BJ when they arrested him. So the specific trajectories of the bullets were analyzed to determine the position of the killer relative to the victims. This suggested an attack was carried out from a position of control. So the immediate actions of the killer further solidified the premeditation theory. Okay, after the attacks, BJ List Jr. did not call for help. He did not surrender or wander aimlessly about. His actions were common in those that have a spontaneous psychotic break. So instead of any of those things, he did the following. He ensured that he had the handgun with him. He took his father's vehicle. And he then drove 170 miles to the family's remote cabin in Carroll County. This sequence of events, the method of attack, the use of two distinct weapon types, and the controlled flight painted the picture of not a man who lost his mind, but of a man who intended to kill and then intended to escape.
That's what I would think.
Right. So there are some things that point to a psychotic break, but there are also things that
there's too much that's not pointing to it.
Right. Okay, so this forensic detail became the cornerstone of the prosecution's case against any type of insanity defense that they would then put forward. So before we dive into the troubled mind of this man that was charged with the murders, we have to spend a moment honoring and fully understanding those that were lost. So this wasn't just a brutal crime. It was an implosion of a family unit. A catastrophe that happened while they were attempting to live just a normal American life. So the victims, those are William List Sr., Susan Sr., and her son Derek Griffin. They were a family unit destroyed from within. So to truly understand the gravity of that loss, we're going to go beyond the basic facts and understand the lives that were taken. So Susan List, like I said, was 46. She was a pillar of a quiet competence and strength. She was born Susan Morris. She was a 1982 graduate of Oak Harbor High School. She held an associate's degree from Terra Community College. Professionally, she was the office manager for Northeast Ohio Carpenters Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee. I still think they could change that name and make it shorter. Her career, which had also included time at Waste Management and Bergman Paving, reflected her dedicated work ethic. She was an active member of the St. John Evangelical Lutheran Church in Oak Harbor. Her friends and family remembered her boundless energy, her love of gardening and camping, and her deep commitment to her sons and her community. Her life was defined by the care she extended to others. She was a stark and painful contrast to the violence that she would ultimately face. Now, William Bill List Sr. was a man defined by service and the outdoors. He found a peaceful existence on his land that he often called his personal heaven. He was a United States Air Force veteran. Bill Sr. embodied a rugged dedication. Following his military service, he worked as a front-end loader operator for Waste Management. His passions were simple and profound: hunting, fishing, and working in his garden. His obituary noted that he was a loving husband and father whose greatest endeavor in his later years was the ceaseless, complicated task of protecting his son, BJ. His role as a guardian was not a legal formality. It was a devotion that ultimately cost him his life. Derek L. Griffin was 23, and he was Susan's son from a previous marriage and BJ's stepbrother, obviously. Derek had no known history of conflict with BJ, who was a young man just beginning his adult life. While Derek's public profile is modest, those who knew him emphasized his gentle nature and his presence as a supportive member of the family. He was an innocent caught in the crossfire, killed to eliminate a witness or because he woke up during the attack. Representing the cruel randomness of BJ's breakdown, not a target of the specific friction that drove the initial plot, but a tragic casualty of the ensuing rampage. This trio, the devoted veteran, the hardworking mother, and the quiet young man, represented a life that was stable, functioning, and committed to perseverance, even under the stress of BJ's ongoing condition. So we know we've met Susan List. She was the hardworking professional and mother, and she was said to be the core of their family. She had married Bill in 2001, blending her family with his.
So they hadn't been married very long when this happened.
Nope.
Damn.
Yep. So when they got married, she blended her family with his. Susan was the primary target, like I said, of BJ's post-hostility and the focus of the well-documented friction that had made the blended family dynamic so volatile. Yet, she worked tirelessly to keep the peace and manage the volatile situation. Her efforts to protect her family are heartbreaking when viewed through the lens of what ultimately happened. Bill was more than just a dedicated Air Force veteran and worker. Sources close to the family say that he saw his son BJ as his best friend and, crucially, BJ's protector. Bill's entire goal after BJ's mental health crisis began was to ensure he got the help he desperately needed. In 2006, Bill was even appointed as BJ's legal guardian due to his son's mental illness, which specifically was documented as psychoaffective disorder bipolar type. So he had a very serious mental illness. And all Bill wanted to do was protect him.
And I get that.
And in the end, it cost all of them their lives. Which, as a parent, that's all you want to do.
Right.
You know, his son couldn't care for himself. He needed somebody to be there. And so he did it because that's his son. Obviously, he never expected anything like this to happen.
No.
So Bill's application to the court was clear, stating that his son could not live at home because of his intense infliction because of BJ and his stepmother, Susan. His plea was to secure a place for BJ in a halfway house or a group home, ensuring distance. So he took over as guardian. BJ came to live with them. And there was a lot of tension, things like that within the family with BJ being there. So rather than just throw his son out, he was trying to find a safe place for him to go to.
Which I get that too.
Right. He wanted things to be calm and all of that, but also ensure that his son was getting the help he needed.
Right.
All of that. So that was in the process. So tragically, the man who spent years trying to save his son and manage the distance became his final intimate victim, found with a blanket over his head. Then there was Derek Griffin, who at 23, he was the oldest adult son of Susan. Unlike Susan, Derek was not reported to have any kind of significant conflict with BJ. He was simply, like I said, an innocent casualty caught.
Lateral damage. Fire.
So the blending of these families created a situation where Bill Sr.'s loyalty was constantly torn. The constant documented friction with Susan was the very reason BJ had been segregated from the home, ended up living in a group home in Sandusky and only visiting on that fatal weekend.
Oh, so he didn't even live there.
Not at the time, no. He did previously. Sorry, I guess I wasn't clear about that. Sorry.
No, I didn't catch it in my brain.
So he did live there at one point, but there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of friction, just a lot of issues. So rather than him split up his family and throw his son out on the street, Bill went to the courts and was looking for a group home or a halfway house, somewhere safe for BJ to be, to where...
Which he did.
It would put distance between all of them, but also ensure that BJ was getting the help he needed. The courts agreed, and they found a place for him to be in Sandusky. He had not stayed at the family home since then until Halloween weekend.
Damn.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Okay, so this fragile, stressful equilibrium maintained by Bill for 4 years. So it was this way for 4 years. It had all finally come to a head and failed on that Halloween morning. So now we turn our attention to the source of the family's terror, and that is William B.J. List Jr. At only 25 years old, B.J. had a severe, well-documented history of mental illness. He had been diagnosed, as I said, with a schizoaffective disorder and bipolar type. This was a combination that severely distorts a person's grasp on reality, leading to mood episodes and, crucially, psychosis. Now, that does not mean that everyone with this mental illness goes out and kills people, okay? Not saying that by any means. There are people out there all over the world that have this exact same diagnosis and live completely normal lives. Just so that is, you know, that's out there. There was a catalyst here. So to fully appreciate the complexity of BJ's case, we have to look closer at that diagnosis that he has in order to really understand. So schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type, is a condition that is often more debilitating and difficult to treat than schizophrenia or bipolar disorder alone.
Damn.
And that is because the patient experiences both severe mood swings and reoccurring symptoms of psychosis. So you're getting both.
You just flipping yourself around.
Basically. Clinically, this means that BJ was not simply suffering from depression or manic highs. He was navigating a distorted reality. The psychosis component means that he experienced hallucinations and or delusions. And bipolar type, these psychotic symptoms are superimposed onto extreme mood swings. So they have periods of intense energy, grandiosity, racing thoughts, and severely impaired judgment. And this friction and aggression that BJ displayed with Susan and his father in the past were likely amplified by these manic episodes.
Dang.
Yeah. People with bipolar type also have periods of profound sadness, lack of energy, and hopelessness. So major depressive episodes as well. So the primary issue, as noted by his father, was that BJ struggled with medication non-compliance, because there is medication to help
right.
with all of these things. BJ's issue was he would not take it. This is a common and very dangerous thing for this disorder specifically. It's dangerous with any type of major mental illnesses like this, but especially this one.
Oh, yeah.
Because their
medicine keeps them kind of on even keel.
Right. It helps with, you know, you don't have the delusions, you don't have the hallucinations, all of that stuff. Without that, there's all kinds of stuff going on in your head. When a patient is delusional with this type of mental illness, they often believe that the medication itself is a threat, often believing it's poison.
A lot of people with psychosis believe mm-hmm. that's why you see them with aluminum foil over their windows, because they yep. think they're trying to read their brains and stuff. Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Or it's along with believing it's poison, a lot of them also think that it's a method of someone else controlling them as well.
Yeah, mind control. That's mm-hmm. what the yep. word I was looking for.
Or that the illness is gone, which leads them to then stop taking the medication.
They feel better.
Right. Which that's the purpose of the medicine.
Right.
So without continuous medication control, the psychosis then returns with frightening intensity. So without the continuous medication, that psychosis returns. And it returns with a frightening intensity.
Oh, yeah. It returns with a vengeance.
Right. It's even worse than it was before you stopped the medication.
That's like getting the flu and 2 weeks later getting it again.
Right. It's always worse than next time around.
No kidding.
This leads to a highly volatile state. And this state existed on the weekend of the murders because BJ stopped his medication. So his commitment to the North Coast behavioral healthcare system after the 2004 assault demonstrated that he was at one time receiving mandated structured care. So once he was put in there by the courts, he was under court order. He had to have structured care, medication, same time, you know, all of that. So when the charges were then dropped 2 years later in 2006, that institutional scaffolding was removed. So now it was up to him if he was going to take his medication or not.
Which he wouldn't.
Right. The burden of enforcing treatment then fell entirely onto Bill through that guardianship he had. This transition from state-mandated care to family-enforced compliance is a notorious weakness in the U.S. mental health system.
The mental health system in this country sucks.
It's shit.
It is shit.
Like, there's a lot of things that need to be fixed and revisited, and the mental health system is one of them. There's a lot of people out there that need help, and they can't get it.
Because they can't get Medicaid,
nope.
or there's not enough psychiatrists.
Nope.
There's not enough mental health care workers to go around.
Some of them just don't care.
Some of them are in just for the fucking paycheck.
Right. Like Mike and I, a few years back, Mike and I we knew him. Mike was more friends with him than I was. There was some addiction issues there as well. But that was self-medication for
they self-medicate because they can't afford. Number one, they can't afford their meds or they can't get them.
Yep. He went to several different doctors and they all told him there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. Nothing wrong with you. But there was. He was hearing voices. He was having hallucinations. And, it's the drugs. It's the drugs. But he went to rehab several times, would get clean, and it would still happen. And ultimately, he ended up killing himself.
Because they can't deal with it anymore.
He felt that was the only way
to stop
for his girlfriend and his kids to have a better life.
Yep. And that's a shame.
Yep. And it happens all the time because our health system is shit.
That's a whole nother topic.
Right. That's a whole nother can of worms that we could sit here and discuss forever.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Okay. So this often is described as as a revolving door phenomenon. And in BJ's case, it led directly to this catastrophe. BJ was meant to be on medication. He was meant to be in treatment. But the nature of his illness, combined with the difficulty of enforcing treatment in the mental health system, meant that his medication schedule was often on again and off again. The family's worst fear had already materialized years before the Halloween massacre, though. So in 2004, 6 years prior to the murders, and I've referenced this before now, BJ List, then 19 years old, committed an act of domestic violence that was an unmistakable preview of the tragedy to come. He was charged with felonious assault and robbery after he had struck his stepmother, Susan, with a coffee cup and then took her car keys. This was an act of personal targeted violence against the person that he was known to have friction with. So this was the case that got him put in the hospital and then charges dropped in 2006. That's that assault. So when the case reached court, a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity was filed. The system recognized that BJ was suffering from a severe condition, and he was ultimately found incompetent to stand trial for that assault charge. He was then committed to the state facility. So this entire thing should have been the turning point. He needs help. We need to get him that help so nothing else from here happens. The system saw the danger, they identified the illness, and they intervened. But the intervention was temporary. In March of 2006, after being found incompetent, BJ's charges were dropped by the state. The legal system effectively released him from the mandatory structure of the criminal justice system, relying instead on his father's guardianship to manage his care. This is a catastrophic system failure in this case. A proven danger, acknowledged mental illness, and a release back to the very stepmother that he had already assaulted. This is the part of the story that raises the most uncomfortable questions. William's struggles weren't a secret. His mother, his doctors, even the courts knew that he was battling serious mental illness. And yet, the safety net meant to catch someone in his state was full of holes. William's violent outbursts weren't a mystery. He had a documented history of psychotic episodes, and time and time again, the system defaulted to leniency. The laws at the time made it nearly impossible to commit someone involuntarily unless they posed an immediate threat. This impossibly high threshold left families like the Lists to shoulder an impossible responsibility to protect someone they love while also protecting themselves. Threats aren't always shouted or written down, as many of us know. Sometimes they're in the unease of how a mother feels when her son grows volatile, or the fear of a stepbrother who doesn't want to be alone in the house with his brother. The system demanded clear, immediate danger, a weapon in hand, a direct threat spoken aloud. Anything less than that was brushed aside as a non-urgent need, highlighting the painful truth that we wait for violence to happen before we take danger seriously. And by then, it's too late.
Exactly.
So by the time the urgency became undeniable, as it always is, it was too late in this case. William's instability wasn't a sudden snap. It was a long, visible unraveling. And in the end, everyone who saw the warning signs was forced to watch, powerless, as that unraveling destroyed an entire family. So what happened in the hours leading up to the murders? We could only piece together the silence that Devin Griffin was met with. We know Bill Sr. was a hunter and owned a handgun. We know that BJ fled with that handgun in his father's truck. The Ottawa County prosecutor, Mark Mulligan, wasted no time after that arrest, quickly stating that the evidence pointed to one conclusion, premeditation. This was key. It meant that the state believed BJ's mental illness did not completely overwhelm his cognitive ability to plan the crime. The act was not a random psychotic break in the heat of the moment. It was cold-blooded execution. And the evidence for premeditation was overwhelming. So first, the victims were attacked while they slept. And this indicated a planned time when they were at their most vulnerable. Next, the choice of weapons and the manner of death, gunshots and bludgeoning. This demonstrates intent to ensure that they were dead, not just cause injury. The attack on three people, including his protective father and innocent stepbrother, was systematic. Then you have a potential witness had reported to the sheriff's office that they had spotted some aspects of the crime, confirming that BJ's movements or actions immediately before or after were observed by someone else, adding concrete evidence that this was a planned operation, not a spontaneous loss of control. And then lastly, you have the escape plan. BJ fled the scene with the murder weapon and his father's vehicle, driving 170 miles to a pre-established remote location, the family's cabin. This is the behavior of a killer attempting to evade capture, not a person who is in the sudden psychotic break. So the List family was not killed by a ghost or a random stranger. They were killed by a monster of circumstance, fueled by a devastating, untreated illness and a systematic failure that allowed a documented threat to return home. The prosecution's assertion of premeditation would shape the entire legal path, a path that ultimately determined BJ List's fate and attempted to provide some semblance of justice for Bill, Susan, and Derek.
So
BJ's capture closed the manhunt, but it opened a legal battle that centered on the very questions the family had been grappling with for years. Was BJ responsible for his actions, or was he a victim of his own mind? Could the law hold a person with severe mental illness accountable for premeditated murder? BJ List Jr. was initially charged with only the murder of his father, and his bond had been set at an immediate $1 million. The prosecutor quickly upgraded those charges to three counts of aggravated murder, meaning the state believed BJ had planned all three attacks and potentially qualified for the death penalty.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So the first major hurdle in this case was the question of competency. Due to BJ's extensive history of severe mental illness, including that schizoaffective disorder, the defense immediately raised doubts about whether he was mentally fit to understand the charges against him or even assist in his own defense. So over the next few months, BJ underwent multiple psychological evaluations. He was first examined at the Court and Diagnostic and Treatment Center in Toledo, and again later at the request of his defense attorney at Twin Valley Behavior Healthcare in Columbus. The final ruling was delivered on March 2011, 4 months after the killing, which was a major turning point in the case. Ottawa County Common Pleas Judge Bruce Winters ruled that BJ List was competent to stand trial.
Oh, crap.
You didn't see that coming, did you?
No, I didn't. But really, he wasn't competent to stand trial.
Yeah, that took me by surprise, too. I don't understand how they ruled him to be competent.
He's a fucking nutcase.
Because he's had... Just because he has a very well-documented history of severe mental illness that, I'm trying to think of my words, that...
Even the most craziest people can be sane sometimes.
Right. His mental illness seems to cloud his actions. But they're the doctors.
We just say.
Right, exactly. They're the doctors. They know which questions to ask and how to tell when someone's faking and when someone's not.
Yeah, they do.
So anyway, this ruling meant that the defense's only remaining route to prevent a conviction was a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. However, winning this plea is extremely rare, especially when the prosecution has strong evidence of premeditation, as is in this case. They have BJ's flight. His flight proves he knows what he did was wrong. His choice of weapon. weapons, shall I say. And he had the gun with him.
He had the state of mind to take it with him.
Mm-hmm. Plus, he attacked them while they were asleep. Those all point to him not being insane at the time. And in order to be able to get reason, not guilty by reason of insanity, you have to prove you were not aware of what you did was wrong at the time that you did it. And that is extremely hard to prove. And very, very rare to happen. So faced with this near certainty of a capital murder conviction and a potential death sentence, a compromise was reached. In September of 2011, less than a year after the murders, William B.J. Lisk Jr. agreed to a plea deal.
I didn't see that coming either.
He entered a plea of guilty to all three counts of aggravated murder. In exchange for his plea, the state dropped the death penalty.
I've seen them do that before.
Yeah, they do that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
A lot more than I think they should, but that's
some of these fucking need to fry.
Right. So on September 15, 2011, B.J. Lisk Jr. stood before Judge Bruce Winters and was sentenced to three consecutive life terms in prison. Members of the surviving family, including Devin, were present in court to hear the final judgment against the man who had destroyed their lives. The sentence was carefully structured. BJ received a life sentence for the murder of his father, a life sentence for the murder of his stepmother, and a life sentence for the murder of his stepbrother. Crucially, the sentences were ordered to be served consecutively, meaning that they were stacked one on top of the other. So you have to consecutively, you have to start one and finish it before the next one starts.
His body ain't never getting out of that prison.
Nope. This ensured that B.J. Lisk Jr. would be required to serve a minimum of 90 years in prison before he would ever be eligible for parole.
He would die in prison.
So that ensures a life sentence without any hope of release. This was a measure of finality that the surviving family, including Devin and Susan's sister Lori, desperately needed in order to move forward. So the day William was sentenced, the courtroom was thick with grief. Rows of wooden benches filled with family members, friends, and neighbors all gathered to witness the formal end of a nightmare. At the front sat Lori, pale and withdrawn, her life split into a before and after that she had never asked for. Devin, still just a teenager, carried the weight of both a survivor and a witness, a boy forced into adulthood far too soon. When the judge read the sentence, life in prison without the possibility of parole, the words landed like stones. No outburst followed, no dramatic collapse, just a suffocating heaviness. The acknowledgement that justice on paper could never touch the wound that was left behind. For the Lisk family, this wasn't closure. It was simply the end of one chapter in a story they never wanted to be a part of. The Lisk triple homicide became a tragic and profound example of the state's flawed mental health system, where the line between criminal culpability and mental illness is often impossible to navigate until after a tragedy occurs. The warnings were clear. The 2004 assault, the ongoing threats, the diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, but the system failed to enforce the long-term mandatory treatment that may have saved three lives. The final chapter of this devastating story closed 4 years later. On April 6, 2015, 4.5 years into his sentence, William B.J. Lisk Jr. was found dead in his prison cell at the Chillicothe Correctional Institution. His death was ruled a suicide.
That don't surprise me.
Yeah. With this final dark turn, the Lisk family tragedy was complete. Three lives lost on Halloween 2010 were eventually followed by the death of their killer, a deeply troubled man whose suffering and the suffering he inflicted was a result of a deadly blend of psychological disease and systematic neglect. The moment B.J. Lisk Jr. was ruled competent, the courtroom became the final high-stakes battleground for his life. The defense stared down the state's three counts of aggravated murder charges that carried the ultimate penalty. The primary goal of BJ's defense team was simple: avoid the death penalty. Their only viable path was to argue his profound mental illness, which made him incapable of forming the specific intent required for murder, which led to their not guilty by insanity defense. But the bar for that defense is impossibly high. They would have to have proved that BJ was so deeply impaired by his schizoaffective disorder that he literally could not distinguish right from wrong on that morning. Prosecutor Mulligan's evidence, though, all pointed to premeditation and a clear awareness of wrongfulness, shattering the foundation needed for his defense. So in Ohio specifically, there is an intermediate option. A plea of guilty, but mentally ill. This plea acknowledges the crime while mandating treatment. However, facing three counts of aggravated murder, the defense's only true leverage was the sheer complexity and emotional risk of a full trial. A long, drawn-out trial revolving around BJ's illness would force the surviving family to relive those horrific details, and it carried a high chance of a death sentence verdict. This immense pressure on both sides, the defense trying to save their client's life, the prosecution trying to guarantee a permanent conviction, led to that inevitable negotiation. It was really the only option they had in the end.
Yeah. But, you know, legally, they cannot execute They cannot execute a mentally ill person.
No, it's just a lie. But I don't know, because he was found competent.
He's not competent, and they knew it.
Which, that's why I don't understand how they even found him competent. It's very clear that he wasn't. And maybe he did premeditate it.
He may have.
But he may have premeditated it in a state of psychosis, though.
Right.
And because he died of suicide only 4 years later, no one will ever know what his state of mind was at that point. Because no one can ever speak to him to try to find out.
That's it. Crazy.
So this resulting agreement was swift and decisive. So September 2011, like I said, only 4 months later, that's very, very fast.
Yeah.
Typically, those things don't happen for years after a murder charge, especially a triple homicide. It happened very quickly.
Yeah.
I think it was a let's close this, because we know who did it. It's open and close.
Right.
Is what I think of more of what it was, rather than...
Let's wipe up this little stain in our community.
Pretty much. That's what I think of more of what it was. I could be wrong, though, obviously. But that's how it seems to me, because it was very, very quickly that this charge happened, trial was set. Typically, that doesn't happen in murder charge, especially three counts of it.
Yeah.
It's usually years after the fact is whenever this stuff starts being put down on the table. So for the prosecution, the motive to accept this plea was clear. It guaranteed justice. It permanently closed the case. It secured three murder convictions, and it removed all risk that BJ being found temporarily insane and returned to a hospital setting there for years. In exchange, like I said, the death penalty was gone. He got to keep his life.
But yet he took his life 4 years later.
Right. So like I said, September...
Allegedly.
Yeah. Allegedly. So on September 15, 2011, like I said, Judge Winters handed down that final sentence. Three consecutive life terms in prison. So this meant absolution. It was done. He would never get out. He could not file for appeals. Nothing, because he took a plea.
Yeah, you lose your chance for appeals if you take a plea.
Yep, it was done. So under Ohio law, each aggravated murder count carried a maximum parole eligibility to you. Period. So I touched on it. I went over it, but now we're like diving into it. If that makes kind of all over the place. I'm sorry. So by stacking them, the sentence guaranteed that List, like I said, would serve a minimum of 90 years. And that's because each sentence, no matter what it is, has a minimum you have to spend before you're eligible.
Of 30 years.
Yeah. So this sentence was the legal system's final declaration. BJ List Jr. would never walk free. It was a sentence designed to be functionally identical to life without parole, ensuring permanent protection for the entire community. The finality of the sentence, 90 years to life. This was not just a legal number, it was the final devastating measure of the family's losses. The sole survivor of the family, Devin Griffin, the 16-year-old boy who returned from church to find his family murdered, was present in that courtroom. His hot Lori also sat next to him, like I said, and she was the first to sound those alarms. They had lived for years with the fear that BJ was dangerous and that Susan had been threatened before, a fear that materialized into reality. As the sentence was read, the courtroom recognized that the killer, the one who had been part of their family, who had played the role of son and stepbrother, was now permanently removed from their lives. The pain was immense. Devin lost his mother, his protective stepfather, and his older brother, Derek. The realization that the tragedy was entirely preventable, the system having failed to keep a proven threat away from the very person that he had previously attacked, makes that loss immeasurable. The 90-year sentence was the closest the law could come to restoring the balance of these three lives taken. In the end, the system's guarantee of 90 years was never needed. The List family was ultimately destroyed by an invisible disease, a system that lacked the tools to manage it, and a final fatal act that shattered the tranquility of a small Ohio town on a holiday morning. With the sentencing complete, the List family tragedy exited the courtroom, but it never left the minds of the surviving family members or the community of Martin, Ohio. So, as BJ sat in prison, he obviously, for those 4 years, struggled with his psychological battle. And being put in prison did not help that in any way. He struggled with the same exact severe mental illness. It had plagued him for a decade before, and it continued to plague him behind prison bars. And ultimately, like I said before, at 29 years old, that drove him to suicide. His death brought an end to that legal process. It ended the possibility of parole or appeal and extinguished the troubled life of the perpetrator. But for those who had survived him, the questions and the pain continued. In the years that followed, the survivors were left to do the impossible, keep living. Devin had to grow up faster than anyone should, carrying the memory of what he saw that morning for the rest of his life. Lori, though devastated, tried to support him and honor the ones they had lost. The community of Martin, too, felt the ripple effect. For months, porches were lined with candles, ribbons tied to mailboxes, neighbors leaving casseroles and cards. Small towns may be quiet, but in the wake of tragedy, that closeness can become a lifeline. Yet no gesture, no visual, no casserole could erase the emptiness that the List family felt. The List case is a devastating illustration of the failure to treat severe chronic mental illness effectively within our legal and healthcare systems. It is ultimately a story of a system that only becomes responsive after the worst possible outcome occurs. The true legacy of the List tragedy extends far beyond the emotional wounds of the family. It represents a profound crisis in the way society handles severe and persistent mental illnesses. This was not merely a crime. It was an institutional failure years in the making. The state of Ohio's legal standard for involuntary commitment or court-mandated treatment is often referred to by the public as the pink slip process, requiring the person to be in immediate danger to themselves or others. This high legal threshold meant that a person like BJ List, who was hostile, unmedicated, and potentially dangerous, could slip through the cracks as long as he wasn't considered an immediate threat on a day-to-day basis. The professional judgment rule protects mental health practitioners from liability when releasing a patient if they made a responsible medical judgment. So that means, well, based off my medical judgment right now, at this moment, he's fine. So I'm going to release him.
Like you're fucking marooned.
And I have no liability. However, the legal system's decision to simply drop the felony charges in 2006, rather than transitioning BJ into a program like guilty but mentally ill, which would have mandated ongoing supervision and medication compliance as a condition of his release, was a critical institutional error. So I get, okay, he's not a danger right now. He doesn't need to be here. So rather than drop the charges, find him guilty but mentally ill. That way, he is still being supervised. He is still being required to be on medication. And if he doesn't, he goes to jail. They failed to do that. When Bill List Sr. took over as guardian, he became the final desperate buffer. His probate court application explicitly stated that BJ could not live at home because of friction between List and his stepmother.
It should have been because of the assault between him and his stepmother. The assault, he hit her with the cup and took her car keys.
Right.
That right there should have got him in mental health.
Yep. But they found him that he was fine, so they released him. And they dropped those charges. And he was allowed to go back over there. So this was a legally documented acknowledgement of immediate danger. This was on legal court papers saying that his stepmother was in danger. Yet, the system had no mechanism to enforce Bill Sr.'s separation plan permanently, allowing BJ to return for visits that ultimately bypassed the very distance that Bill Sr. had fought so hard to create.
But technically, and really, he was an adult, so they could have not gotten the visitation.
But his dad had guardianship. Which meant that he did. So in the eyes of the law, because his dad had guardianship, he wasn't like an adult like me and you could just go do whatever they wanted. He was basically the guardianship, like as if he wasn't.
Still don't make no sense to me, but
so
okay.
It's like
no, I get it. I get it. Like, but what I'm saying is with his mental defect.
Mm-hmm.
They could put a restraining order on him and not let him come visit because of the threat of that violence.
Yeah, but his dad was also very protective. He may not have trusted anyone else to, you know what I mean?
Well, sometimes mom and dad's got to bite the bullet.
I know.
Well, anyway,
it's a hard situation to be in.
It is.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we could say we would do this or not do that.
But you don't know what you'll do unless you're in that situation.
Right.
You know.
This is one of those things he wanted to protect his wife.
And he wanted to protect his son at the same time. And I get that.
Yep. So sometimes it's hard to choose.
Half a dozen, one, six, the other.
Right. Right. Exactly. And it sucks that he was ever put in that position to begin with.
Right.
Because he tried to get help.
The state, when he attacked his stepmother and took her car, the state should have put him in a mental institution right then and there.
And not released him.
And never released him.
And Bill Sr., he tried to get help. He did everything he could to get help for his son, to protect his wife, and the system failed all of them. Failed them all majorly. Okay. The final fatal visit was a tragic loophole in a system that prioritized procedural discharge over long-term public and familial safety. The lack of robust, accessible, and mandatory community-based treatment for high-risk individuals is the silent accomplice in this triple murder. So we are going to go back to the 2004 incident, which was the attack where BJ had struck Susan with that coffee cup. That event was the most critical missed warning sign. The court system recognized that danger and BJ's incapacity, finding him incompetent to stand trial for that.
Right then and there, they should have put him in a mental institute.
And they committed him to treatment. But when those charges were dropped, that mandatory commitment was lost. He was set.
They should have never lifted that mandatory.
I get the charges were dropped.
Yeah, I do too.
But because he was not competent to stand trial, which means he should
he's
not...
He's a Looney Tune motherfucker. Pay attention.
He should not have been taken off of that mandatory structure for his medication.
No, because he was doing good on it.
Right. And it happens so many times. Just, it's ridiculous. So the management of BJ's care fell back entirely onto, like we've said, his father. That desperate cry for help, where he wanted to protect both his wife and his son, no matter what his love was, no matter how hard he tried, Love no just, government institution would help.
And love just isn't enough.
He could not ensure that his son took his medication, and he could not force his son to permanently stay separated from them just because of that previous attack. They wouldn't help him in any way. That result alone, that one thing, triggered the tragedy. The system waited for BJ to become a criminal before it intervened. And then it failed to ensure that permanent safety once he was released from mandatory custody. And that paved the road for him to commit a triple murder. The community of Martin, Ohio has forever been scarred by the monstrous conclusion of this illness. The murders were not random. They were intimate and familial violence. The horror for Devin Griffin, who lost his mother, his brother, his father figure, and one unspeakable act, remains a permanent wound forever. The concept of the killer being a family member complicates the grief, merging love, betrayal, and terror all into enduring trauma for him. The legacy of the Lisk family massacre is a chilling question. How many warnings do we need before the system provides the mandatory long-term care necessary to prevent such violence? The Lisk family gave the system a very clear warning in 2004. They gave another clear warning in the years that they had spent trying to manage BJ's care. Yet on Halloween 2010, that invisible disease and the system's failure claimed all three of their lives in rural Ohio. The lives of Bill Sr., Susan, and Derek ended that night, leaving behind a profound reminder that for some families, the greatest danger does not lurk in the shadows. It is the one sitting at the dinner table, struggling with a mind that the world doesn't know how to fix. And that is where we close the painful, complex case of the Lisk family murders.
Damn.
It remains one of the most tragic examples of systematic failure, compounding a personal crisis, leaving permanent scars on the community of Martin, Ohio, and reminding all of us that sometimes the most frightening threats are the ones that we try the hardest to love. The Lisk family murders still stands as a devastating reminder of how quickly safety can be shattered. This forced us to ask those difficult questions. How do we recognize true danger when it hides in plain sight? How do we balance compassion for mental illness with protection for those that are vulnerable? And why does it so often take tragedy for the system to act? William wasn't a shadowy stranger lurking in the dark. He was family. Someone who should have been a protector, not a killer. And that, in many ways, is what makes this case so haunting. It wasn't evil that came from outside. It was already inside. So Halloween stories usually end with the lights coming back on and monsters vanished and the illusion of safety restored. But the Lisk case does not give us that. There's no neat ending, no comfort in saying the evil was supernatural or imagined. Instead, it forces us to live with the truth that sometimes the scariest monsters don't wear costumes. They don't lurk in abandoned houses or haunted woods. Sometimes they carry your last name. Sometimes they share your blood. And maybe that's why this story has lingered after the headlines have long faded. It's not just about what happened inside one house in Martin, Ohio. It's about the terrifying possibility that such horror can happen anywhere, on any given night when the rest of the world is celebrating fear as a game. And that's it.
That was just crazy. No pun intended.
Right.
I told you there's some sick puppies out there.
I know. Yep, that one is, thought it was a good one to do because it happened on Halloween. It's a good time to do it. The anniversary for this one is coming up. So I thought, why not do it now?
Right.
But it also covers a lot of just shit that's wrong. Like, we all know that our justice system is fucked and really needs to be revisited. The mental health system
is so broken. It is so broken.
It is so much worse than the justice system itself is.
It's so broken. It really is. And it always has been. There is too much mental illness out in the world and not enough help for it.
Right. Like, the justice system needs to be fixed. That is something that has always been a fact. And we know that. And people everywhere lobby and fight for that. But what about the mental health?
But then you add mental health into the criminal sector. And it just...
It's pretty much non-existent.
Exactly.
It's lobby for the justice system to be fixed, because it does need to be fixed. It is broken. But...
Don't forget the mental illness.
Exactly.
Either.
The mental illness part is so bad.
It has a lot to do with the justice
system. It does. A lot of times they go hand in hand. If you fix one, you're going to do a lot to fix the other too. When it comes to the
legalities of it.
Right. But even just the everyday person, it is not an easy thing. You know, not everyone has health insurance. And because of that, they can't get mental health
treatment. Then even if you got health insurance, you got to fight with the insurance company. You know, you got to fight with the insurance company to get the help you need.
Yep.
And it shouldn't be that way.
No, it shouldn't. I get people, you know, there's a lot of people who doctor shop. Okay. That is a thing. We have systems now for that reason. If you're going to one doctor and this doctor won't give you the medication you want, you go to another doctor and you continue to do it, that is going to be seen. Those things are going to be recognized and red flags are going to go up. But not everyone is like that. Some people, you know, I know something's wrong with me and you're telling me there's nothing wrong, but I know there is. So I'm going to go get a second opinion. But you go get a second opinion and you're penalized for that.
But with mental health, they need a support system.
And
it's so expensive
that so many people can't afford it. And it's just outrageous to me.
Oh, I know, honey.
It's ridiculous. I can't imagine if I was still on my anxiety medication, how much it would be today. Cannot imagine how much
I'd have
to
look, see how much mine is.
Because my
headache, well, because with my insurance.
Right, right. Yours is different than what mine is through work.
Yeah, right. Because I'm retired.
Right. It's outrageous. If you would help people who have mental illness and ensure that they get the treatment that they need, whether it's medication or therapy
or whatever they need to have.
Right. Things in the world would be so much better. And I'm not saying that it's any one person's fault, obviously.
No.
But there are so many things that would be better. Every person's life would be so much better.
Oh, yeah.
There would be less suicides.
Yeah.
Because the leading cause of suicide is mental illness. And it's because they can't get the help that they desperately need.
Right. Oh, I know, honey.
It's just, it's awful. It's ridiculous. And this case is one of those cases that really shows that.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%.
There are a ton out there, but this one I think really is one of the biggest ones that really, it really
shows where the system failed that kid.
Right. It failed him. It failed his entire family.
Exactly.
All of them. And it's just, it's ridiculous. So anyway, sorry guys, kind of went on a ramble there. So thank you for taking this journey with us through all the evidence, through those legal battles, through that profound human tragedy at the heart of this case, through the systematic failures, all of that, your support, you keep listening to us, allows us to continue delving into these dark corners of our
history. Yes, keep listening to my girls.
Of our history and crimes. So join us again on Friday. You're going to hear me talk. You're going to hear Mama talk some more. It's going to be a split episode.
You're going to have it wrote down for me, right?
I got it. Yep. That one's going to be a split episode. We're going to go back into the haunting of some things for Friday.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Going to dive deep into that. We're going to get our water wings wet.
Lord, I sink to the bottom.
All right. So come back on Friday. So that way you can get your water wings wet with us, guys. So we hope you enjoyed listening to this one. If you're not subscribed, subscribe, hit your little bell notification, rate us wherever you get those podcasts. If you enjoyed this one, make Make sure you share it with someone who may enjoy these cases as much as you do. You can find us on Facebook. That link's in the description as always. You can also find us on TikTok and Patreon. Our email is also in the description for your listener tales and case suggestions. And until next time, we hope you keep listening and remember to
watch for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.